Today in Studio 360, the most appalling, rapacious SOB on movie screens right now is played by Leonardo DiCaprio in The Wolf of Wall Street as a financial wheeler-dealer pushing greed and depravity to new heights.
Sure, we'll be seeing each other real soon.
I'm sure. Good luck on that subway ride home to your miserable, ugly wives.
DiCaprio has sort of become an expert in playing morally bankrupt rich guys.
With The Great Gatsby and Django and this film, in a lot of ways, it was like a trilogy of corruption in America.
And, and later on in the show, the most well-intentioned guy in theaters this season, a sweet loser, as only Ben Stiller can play one.
He's kind of like a guy on the bench ready to go into the game who hasn't really figured out how to get in the game.
Ben Stiller's remake of The Secret Life of Walter Mitty. That and much more is ahead this hour in Studio 360, right after this.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com. And by Lookout. Lookout is dedicated to helping protect people and businesses from mobile threats, including device loss, malware, and spyware. You can download the Lookout app for Android and iPhone today. Learn more at Lookout.com.
This is Studio 360, and I'm Kurt Anderson.
This is the greatest company in the world!
Today in the show, I'll talk with Leo DiCaprio about his amazing and controversial portrayal of a real-life corrupt stockbroker who indulges every urge he's ever had.
$26,000 for one dinner!
And we'll talk with the first of the brave listeners who shared their New Year's resolutions with us. This one, a certified rock star.
Well, I want to do a staged version of the Book of Revelation.
But first, the Minnesota Orchestra had it all. Well-paid, top-notch musicians, a star conductor, Osmo Vanska, who helped them become world-class over the last decade, a devoted audience in one of the most philanthropic cities in America. But then something went terribly wrong. Contract negotiations broke down, management canceled an entire season of performances, and the maestro quit. Now the musicians of the Minnesota Orchestra have raised $650,000 to put on their own short season of 10 concerts around the city beginning this weekend. Graydon Royce, a critic and reporter for the Star Tribune in Minneapolis, joins me now. Graydon, welcome.
Hi, Kurt.
Classical music all over the country has been having tough times, and we've seen lots of other difficult contract negotiations with symphonies and their players. It's never gotten quite as two sides on either side of a barricade as it's gotten in Minneapolis, has it?
I can say without hyperbole, this is the most serious labor dispute in certainly the last 40, 50 years in the American symphonic world. Detroit had a strike a few years ago that lasted 6 months. The lockout began in October of 2012. So, it is kind of way above every previous situation.
So, as succinctly as possible, can you explain this incredibly complicated story for our listeners?
Well, at its very basic, it is a labor dispute. The management and the board of the Minnesota Orchestra feels that it has spending too much money on its labor costs, primarily the musicians' contract. The musicians feel that they have achieved everything they have been asked to achieve over the last several years in becoming a world-class ensemble under Osmo Vanska. And they feel insulted by the terms that the orchestra management and board have presented. And therefore, the two sides have not been able to reach a contract agreement.
And it's over the musicians' salaries being reduced.
That's the issue, is pretty serious cuts to compensation.
And the musicians are pretty well paid. What is a typical salary for these players?
Well, a base salary in the old contract was $113,000, $115,000, right in that range. That was the base salary. And then, of course, there's merit pay on top of that.
Right. And this has been going on for more than a year, and it's gotten pretty ugly, hasn't it? Is that the way it feels to you?
You know, at some point, this thing gets to a point of personalities, and it gets to a point of, you know, one side not wanting to be seen as though we are giving in to the other side. It kind of gets beyond money.
And when I see things like the fact that the management bought up these domain names that might be used by
right.
the other side, Save Our Minnesota Orchestra and so forth,
right.
That,
right.
that's – I don't know if that's ugly, but it's hardball.
Well, yeah. It's definitely hardball.
Which is all the more surprising to somebody who doesn't live there because in my experience, the stereotype about people in Minneapolis and Minnesota being nice is true.
Well, you just got to cut deeper, Kurt, and you can find the ugly side inside
sure,
us. Trust me.
I'm sure that's true.
We have this reputation, but at the same time, there's a lot of, you know, if you ever read the book Main Street, I mean, there's
right.
a deep insides to the Minnesotan.
And how does sentiment in Minneapolis break down among people who care about this, between for and against, and who you're for?
Among people who really care about this, I think most of those people are pro-musician. But I think that there is a large group of people who just say, I don't care. I want this thing to stop. I'm not interested in reading about it anymore. I'm not interested
yeah.
in hearing about it. Solve your difficulties. It's just becoming pathetic.
A pox on both your houses, kind of.
Yeah, yeah.
And do you think the orchestra can come back from this without permanent damage?
Well, a couple of things there. Number one is if Vanska, who has not talked since he left the orchestra in October, if he were persuaded to come back and lead the ensemble, I think that would do a lot. There are really great players in the orchestra. You know, we've lost some of those. Whether they will come back is another big question. There may be also some of that Minnesota sense of we are overachievers here, that if we're in a tough situation, we typically will work extra hard. I mean, that is one of the parts of the Minnesota work ethic.
This season, this self-funded season that the orchestra is just beginning, is that going to be a big thing? Will people attend because of the politics of this?
I think they'll attend because of the music. But there's also a really, really strong, committed crowd of people who are going to these concerts to support the musicians. And I don't see any reason why that will slack off at all. So I expect them to be very well attended. Probably most of them sell out.
And is it your best guess that in this year of 2014, this will be settled and resolved and they'll be back in their seats in a normal way playing for the happy audiences?
Yeah. I think that somehow in the calendar year 2014, the Minnesota Orchestra will be back on stage. It almost seems like a dream to say that, but they have to come to an agreement at some point.
Graydon Royce, thanks so much.
Thank you, Kurt.
Graydon Royce is a critic and reporter for the Star Tribune in Minneapolis. In Minneapolis this weekend, the Locked Out Musicians will be performing pieces by Beethoven, Benjamin Britten, and Mozart's Requiem. So the last offer that the orchestra management put on the table was over $100,000 for base pay for musicians. What do you think? Should they have taken that? Let us know at studio360.org. The last few weeks, I've been asking you to share your creative resolutions for 2014, any kind of artistic project you think you can bite off in a year with a little help from Studio 360. 300 of you shared your creative plans for the year, which was awesome. One person who posted on our site was Mike Doty, who was the frontman of the 90s band Soul Coughing. Mike's got a resolution that we couldn't resist, so we asked him to tell us about it. Mike Doty, welcome to Studio 360.
Thanks, man.
So we love hearing about these resolutions here, especially the insanely ambitious ones, and which yours seems to belong to that category. Describe what you want to do.
Well, I want to do a staged version of the Book of Revelation.
The last book of the Christian Bible.
The loopy, utterly insane, virtually plotless, bizarre mishigas of psychedelic imagery that is the Book of
Armageddon,
Revelation.
Armageddon, Apocalypse, it's
exactly,
all.
Exactly. Yeah.
Which has become popular again in the last 25 years or so in a way it wasn't when I was a kid.
Well, yeah. I mean, I grew up a heavy metal kid. So, you know, walking around listening to Iron Maiden, that was really my introduction to it.
Were there explicit Iron Maiden songs about
Revelation? There was a song called Number of the Beast. They actually say, you know, in this portentous English voice, "Let him who hath understanding
reckon the number of the beast, for it is a human number. Its number is 666.
It's so goofy, but it was so compelling as a 13-year-old.
And so this thing you're going to make, what is it going to be? What's it going to look like?
Well, I think it's going to be myself as a sort of preacher character, another sort of angel character, and it's going to be more presentational than done as a story. So it's almost like an oratorio with costuming. I want there to be projections of the different beasts.
Will you be playing instruments or will it be recorded?
Yeah, oh, there will be a small band, probably. Uh-huh. I mean, you know, the problem with saying this stuff out loud is instantly it changes 2 days later.
And how long have you been toying with this notion?
A couple of years. I mean, as a matter of fact, I was staring at the 5 translations I had just bought on Amazon when you guys announced that you were doing this on the radio.
The translations of the Book of Revelation?
Of the Book of Revelation.
So you're not just sticking with King James, you're going...
The way the Book of Revelation is written is like a bad fiction writer who introduces characters and then through the rest of the novel just says, the guy. You know, he's very specific about, like, you know, the angel that has the bronze and the thing's on fire and there's the blood and the blah, blah, blah. And then, you know, 2 verses later, it's the angel. Well, which one of the 50 angels that you've introduced is this angel? So it's a really like task one is going through all the translations and picking out what is essential and what is non-essential, writing an outline, breaking it down.
So you want to go for the producible screenplay rather than the beautiful literary version.
Well, you know, honestly, it's, you know, the imagery is such that, like, if you like the Avengers, you'll love the Book of Revelation.
And are you particularly religious, irreligious? Where do you stand on the Bible?
Well, obviously, I think it's literal and it's going to happen. And, you know,
I don't believe you're telling me the truth.
I'm not telling you the truth. You know, I mean, like, I'm a recovering addict and I have that whole sort of higher power mishigas, which is not necessarily a belief in God. And I'm not a Christian, although I grew up in a very conservative environment. My dad was in the army. So I think I have more respect and understanding for evangelical Christianity and Mormonism and other sort of very strict religious groups than your average, you know, groovy guy that lives in Williamsburg.
I want to play a short clip from a recent song of yours. It's called Sunshine.
We can get together on the memory phone. The only here is here. Dark is dissipating like a bad idea. We got everything but time.
And I played that because, of course, it's apt for what you're proposing to do. We got everything but time. So you got a year to create this epic piece of art.
I know, man. I mean, it was simultaneously thrilling when you guys called up and, you know, gave me the nod. And then suddenly it was like, oh, now I have to do this thing.
Well, I, for one, cannot wait to see it.
Groovy.
We will be checking in on Mike Doty throughout the year, and we'll hear in coming weeks about the other creative New Year's resolutions that we'll be monitoring during 2014.
And now the deal is sealed. Yeah, I'm writing this thing. Good Lord.
Yep. Coming up, Leonardo DiCaprio, who spent months of his life improvising sex scenes, drug binges, and mayhem for The Wolf of Wall Street.
It was an incredibly freeing set. Everybody gave into every carnal indulgence. By no means did we go home and, you know, have orgies.
Now Leo DiCaprio is fending off critics who say the film celebrates amorality. That's next in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us.
Studio 360 is supported by Lumosity.com, the brain training program designed by neuroscientists and used by 50 million people, created to improve memory and attention. More at Lumosity.com. And by Lookout, Lookout is dedicated to helping protect people and businesses from mobile threats, including device loss, malware, and spyware. You can download the Lookout app for Android and iPhone today. Learn more at lookout.com.
But soft. What light the window breaks?
This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
Hello, old sport.
Leonardo DiCaprio is one of the few actors working today who can get pretty much any movie made. So, what roles is he looking for? Mostly liars, criminals, sociopaths, tortured souls. In his latest film, The Wolf of Wall Street, a combination of all of those. Jordan Belfort was a stockbroker in the late 80s and early 90s whose ripoffs and financial crimes were matched by his personal living large depravity. And this isn't just another role for DiCaprio. He played a big part in getting The Wolf of Wall Street made, even convincing Martin Scorsese to direct the film. His performance as the atrocious Jordan Belfort is being called the best of his career, and he was up for a Golden Globe at this week's awards. Leonardo DiCaprio, welcome to Studio 360.
Thank you very much. Glad to be here.
So first off, congratulations on the Golden Globes and the new all-time record for F-bombs in a motion picture.
Yes, I heard. We broke the record.
Not bad for a movie about finance. 506.
Yeah, not with the term Wall Street in the title, it's pretty dubious achievement.
Now, when people say, as they have said, this is the best performance he's ever given, are you inclined to agree?
Look, I'm incredibly proud of the performance. We had a much different approach going into this project than many of the other ones we had. I remember watching The King of Comedy early on and seeing the sort of organized chaos that Marty created with the actors, wherein they improvised even before the film started, and then they sort of re-improvised the improvised material. So it was really a free-form kind of film that you don't really get to see made in coming from the Hollywood studio system, which is one of the reasons why I've wanted to do it for such a long period of time. It was a six-year process to get the film made.
You mentioned King of Comedy. One forgets that Martin Scorsese has made a comedy, a weird, dark comedy, but nevertheless, like this, a comedy.
Not to mention he originally considered Goodfellas a comedy as well.
Well, that's just him.
Yeah.
I want to play a clip from Wolf of Wall Street in which you and some of your fellow executives are justifying exorbitant expenses to your father, played by Rob Reiner, who works with you at the brokerage.
Jordy, look what you got here.
What?
Look at this. $26,000 for one dinner.
No. This could be explained. Dad, we had client. We had the Pfizer clients.
Right. The porterhouse from Argentina.
The expensive champagne and the wine. We had to buy champagne. And you ordered all the sides. Tell them about the sides.
I ordered the sides.
Sides?
Yeah.
Sides? $26,000 worth of sides? What are these sides? They cure cancer?
The sides did cure cancer. That's the problem. That's why they were expensive.
Shut up.
I'm serious. I know.
Stop.
So given that you guys were constantly improvising scenes of these crazy bros eating and drinking and snorting and having sex, leaving no temptation unindulged, at the end of the workday, was it hard to go back to normality?
I suppose, you know, we all took on a different attitude while making this movie. By no means did we go home and, you know, have orgies.
Oh, darn.
But, you know, it was an incredibly freeing set. Everybody gave into every carnal indulgence on set, and we looked at this like, the Roman Empire. We looked at it, you know, short of virgin maidens feeding us grapes, we put everything we possibly could into this movie.
And that didn't work out too well for the Romans.
No, it didn't. Exactly.
So there are those crazy, improvised, over-the-top, drugged-out scenes. Then there are several times these serious, heartfelt monologues you give to your staff, these people who really believe in you, whom you've assembled to work in your shady brokerage. That's not like anything I've ever seen you do.
Those speeches, which to me were like Braveheart war cries for greed in a lot of ways, were things that I was thinking about for 6-7 years. Those are some of the most well-written speeches I'd ever come across. So I'd done tons of research on motivational speaking. I spoke to Jordan. I read up on exactly the way some of these guys communicate in Wall Street.
Uh-huh.
And it was interesting because I'd been thinking about them so much the day before I was supposed to do them. My throat seized up with strep throat and I couldn't say any of them.
Huh.
It was almost like I had this actor's block, which was great because it gave me another month to sort of think about them and do even more research. So on the day, it became this entirely different animal.
You started trying to get this movie made before the meltdown and the recession. When the recession happened and the meltdown happened, did you go, oh, now I can get this made?
Not necessarily. I think it's always a tough subject matter. I think that, you know, look, this is a hard R. There's lots of drugs, sex, profanity in the film. But to me, you know, when I went into this world, not knowing much about the world of finance and Wall Street, I thought, okay, these are the people that are responsible for the economic meltdown. And then I realized, no, wait a minute. These guys are outsiders,
right,
trying to emulate Gordon Gekko.
Right.
These are the guys that are in Long Island that are trying to be the fat cats on Wall Street that were simultaneously robbing destroying our economy. So it represented something more in our very culture,
right,
this attitude,
right,
of gaining wealth at any cost and feeding into every sort of carnal desire you possibly can. And we very purposefully, I think, in this film, made a decision, which is why there's probably been some controversy. We didn't want to show the wake of their destruction. And I think that, you know, we did that very consciously because, you know, in a film, you wanted to be transported into somebody else's mindset. That's what's so powerful about cinema as an art form. And we wanted people to get closer to the understanding of, you know, where these people are and ultimately what motivates them and how it can be such an elusive, enticing world to be in.
I think you've hit on the interesting point of why there is this ongoing, emphatic, emotional debate about, oh, do they glorify these people or not? Since I ended up feeling literally nauseous by seeing the amount of drugs that these characters ingest. But as you say, because you don't show their destruction, I guess that's what made people say, hey, they're not showing that these guys are really bad, and because it's a comedy as well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that, you know, Marty ultimately said, look, this is incredibly funny, but what we're talking about is not funny. And I'm not going to make a traditional movie that, you know, has a didactic ending where we explain to the audience exactly the way they should feel and digest what they've just seen. I want to throw them, you know, headfirst into this world unapologetically and not judge these people because ultimately they represent something about the world we live in and the darker nature of all of us. And to me, that's a timeless, interesting approach to making a film. And he said to me early on, he said, look, I've done many films about disreputable characters. You know, he's sort of the master of it in a lot of ways. And he said, as long as you don't apologize for their actions and portray them as authentically as you possibly can, people will go along on that journey. And I think Marty's films always have been about the pursuit of the American dream in a lot of ways, the corruption of that dream and the hustle that it takes to get there.
Speaking about playing bad, greedy man, I want to play a clip from Django Unchained in which your character, a guy named Calvin Candy, is negotiating the sale of one of his slaves.
And if y'all want to leave Candyland with Broomhilda, the price is $12,000.
And I take it you prefer the take-it-or-leave-it style of negotiation?
Yes, I do, Doctor. You see, under the laws of Chickasaw County, Broomhilda here is my property. And I can choose to do with my property whatever I so desire.
Between Django and Wolf of Wall Street and The Great Gatsby, which you film back-to-back, you have really become a specialist in monstrous rich guys. And I wonder how come.
It's an interesting question. You know, with The Great Gatsby and Django and this film, in a lot of ways it was like a trilogy of corruption in America,
yeah,
through different time periods. I mean, I suppose it probably stems from, you know, having a poor upbringing in Los Angeles and being accepted into, you know, the University of Elementary School, which was a school where, you know, they tried to integrate a lot of different kids together. And I got to go see how the other half lived. you know? And I think since then...
You mean the richer half?
Yeah. It's been a fascination with that world and a fascination with, you know, how they got there. And you know, stories of corruption in America, to me, I mean, they're a fascinating thing to explore. I mean, I look at the world around us sometimes and it's bizarre. It's surreal to me how the almighty dollar is so incredibly powerful and destructive at the same time.
Well, so, and you, as you say, you grow up without a lot of money, although your father was a great underground comic artist whose work I read as a kid myself. But now you are living how the other half lives, not doing coke and corruption, I assume, all the time. Do you have a different view of it, or have you taken that kind of 12-year-old view into the posh Hollywood world that you inhabit now?
Absolutely. You know, I don't. I think it's actually, you know, I think it's a moral responsibility to give back. Truly, I really do. I think that, you know, to me, I'm almost living in a surreal fantasy world myself. I've gotten at a young age to decide what I wanted to do as a profession, and luckily enough, I've gotten to be successful at it. So, to me, it's, you know, without giving back and without trying to do something either positive for your community or the world around you, all of it really means nothing.
You don't do this thing, it seems, that other movie stars do, which is, oh, I'll make one big, you know, surefire blockbuster thing where I put on tights and play a superhero, and then I'll do the good movie, and then I'll do the other payday movie, and then I'll do a good movie. You do, it seems, only movies that are kind of difficult and complicated and dark and ambitious.
Well, I appreciate you saying that. Thank you. But the truth is that when I got my first role in This Boy's Life, I was 15 years old, and I came from the world of television. And I finally realized, okay, I'm working with somebody that's of A-plus caliber and Robert De Niro.
Yeah.
And it led me to really watching movies for a year straight, every single day, as many movies as I possibly could. And I think at that age you get so unbelievably overwhelmed with what's been done before you that for me I just felt this strange responsibility to attempt to emulate to do something that good in my lifetime. And then
right.
That becomes something that I think is you're never satisfied. No matter what you achieve, you always try to achieve more. And to tell you the truth, doing a lot of these movies are incredibly long endeavors, and they take a lot of your energy and a lot of your thought, and they consume a lot of your life. And, you know, my attitude has been pretty much the same ever since I've been 15, and it hasn't really changed, which is, look, if you're going to invest your time in something, you know, try to swing for the fences at least.
Right.
You're never always going to hit a home run. You may hit a single sometimes, but, you know, if you're given that opportunity, I've always looked at it as somewhat of a responsibility to try to make the best of it.
Are you moving on perhaps to a brighter side of the street in your next project or two?
Maybe not.
No, you're going to stick with the greed and corruption failed American
dream?
I don't
know if it's greed and corruption. That's certainly not the case, but I mean,
yeah.
I don't know. To me, the films that have impacted me the most in my life, everything from the, you know, The Bicycle Thief to East of Eden to 2001 to Taxi Driver, are films with characters at the lead that are somewhat tortured, and that's just the way it is. And that's kind of what I like, and that's what affected me as a 15-year-old kid. That's what moved me and made me want to do movies. So we'll see.
Well, I look forward to the next one. Thank you for being here today.
Thank you so much. That was a great conversation. I appreciate it. You know I'm the wolf, baby.
You know I stay in the wolf. Leonardo DiCaprio stars in The Wolf of Wall Street, which you can see anywhere if you're over age 18 or accompanied by an adult who is sure to regret having brought you. Leo's up for a Golden Globe for his performance. And if you're into that sort of thing, check out our awards night bingo at studio360.org this week. It makes watching a whole lot more fun. Coming up...
I'm Walter. Mitty.
Cheryl. Melhoff.
Where have you been?
Testing the limits of the human spirit.
Ben Stiller's new movie is about as far from Wall Street as you can get. He's playing the iconic daydreamer Walter Mitty, who first appeared in a short story 75 years ago.
Daydreaming back then was probably much more of a go-to thing. Nowadays, you know, if you want to get distracted, you look at your phone or you look at your computer or, you know, play a video game or something.
We'll stay focused on Ben Stiller. He's just ahead in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC. Stay with us. This is Studio 360. I'm Kurt Anderson.
I just like to daydream. It's my little Walter Mitty self, I guess.
There are very few characters in literature whose names become a kind of shorthand, like somebody who's always lost in grandiose daydreaming. You call them a Walter Mitty, based on the 1939 short story by James Thurber. A decade later, it was made into a musical starring Danny Kaye.
Walter Mitty, the lovable henpecked dreamer.
Walter, what's the matter with you?
Now, Ben Stiller, who plays a sad sack like nobody else in Hollywood, has taken on the role of Mitty. It's the fourth film he's both directed and starred in.
In the movie, we sort of wanted to hold true to the tone of the short story, but he's a guy who likes the woman at work that Kristen Wiig plays, and he works at Life magazine, which is something we invented for the movie.
You didn't invent Life magazine, let's be clear.
We did not invent Life, but we did resurrect it for the movie.
You did.
Yeah, resurrected it as it was being shut down.
And we don't quite, in the story, we don't quite know who Walter Mitty is. So you had to sort of figure out who this guy is. He's middle-aged, because you're middle-aged.
Yes.
And he's lonely, but he doesn't seem to think of himself as a loser. His horrible jerk boss regards him that way. But we're not supposed to think of him that way, are we?
Not at all. No, I think he's sort of just an ordinary guy, you know, a guy who hasn't really connected with his potential and kind of, you know, his idea of what he wanted to be or who he wanted to be in his life. And he got sidetracked by real life responsibilities. And so in that way, I wanted him to just kind of be a very relatable person.
And not be henpecked by a wife.
No, and that was something Steve Conrad, who wrote the screenplay, made a choice about having the women actually be really positive influences in his life, his mom that Shirley MacLaine plays and Kristen, and not have it be about sort of a guy trying to escape that.
I want to play a clip from one of the scenes in the movie where Walter escapes into his daydreams. This is from early in the film where he's on the phone with an operator from eHarmony, played by Patton Oswalt, who is trying to help him fill out his eHarmony profile, and he slips into this adventure.
Okay, well, I haven't really been anywhere noteworthy or mentionable.
Have you done anything noteworthy, mentionable? Hello? You still there?
Can you hang on a second?
It works as an audio thing, doesn't it?
Fascinated listening to a cliff. It's
Chips! Thank you! How'd you know about the building?
I heard barking, thought I smelled gas. Oh, I hope it's okay. I engineered a prosthesis for Chips while I was sprinting down the stairwell. Little hip joint assembly with a drop ring lock and an anterior pelvic band.
God, you're noteworthy!
I just live by the ABCs. Adventurous, brave, creative.
That's everything I want in a man.
That is Ben Stiller jumping into a burning building and saving a dog and winning the girl in
yes.
The Secret Life of Walter Mitty. That happens again and again in the first half of the movie anyway. And it's interesting, of course, because we're watching a movie. And we're watching a movie at a time when most big movies are that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think his daydreams are sort of fueled by sort of all the, you know, pop culture in his head. And I wanted it to sort of relate to sort of, you know, I think the world that we're in now in terms of there's so much, you know, so much to, in terms of visual stimulus.
Which the Thurber story did too. I mean, those were essentially movie scenes. That was Casablanca essentially, although before Casablanca.
Yeah, no, I mean, in 1939, it's interesting because there was a lot less visual, you know, distraction. And there was movies and that was about it. So, you know, it's kind of interesting the idea that daydreaming back then was probably much more of a go-to thing as nowadays where, you know, if you want to get distracted, you look at your phone or you look at your computer or, you know, play a video game or something.
And your daydreams were probably more original and authentic in some way because you weren't just taking them from James Bond.
Yeah. I mean, if it was a different world. I really wonder what it would have been like to live back then and not have all that.
in that scene we just heard and in many other scenes, there's tremendous amounts of CGI, obviously. That was a new thing for you as a director to do, yeah?
Yeah, I mean, for me, I wanted the I wanted it all to be as reality-based as possible, especially when we were starting to think about what his fantasies were and try to when you have sort of every option in the world, it basically as, what you could do, it kind of forces you to focus more on like, well, what is the – thematically, what are we saying with his daydreams? And for me, I wanted them to be sort of reality-based and New York-based. I wanted it sort of – he's a guy who lives in New York and really his imagination maybe doesn't take him that far out. Even if he's imagining that he's on a – in like an Arctic tundra, it's right. Part of his office,
Or battling his boss down 6th Avenue.
Yes, exactly. And so that was sort of an idea that we decided to go with and then try to do as much stuff for real as possible, like the 6th Avenue battle where they're riding concrete snowboards and parking lines that are like skis. We did on skateboards and rollerblades on 5th Avenue and on 57th Street and then, augmented it with the CGI. But I wanted to try to do as much for real as possible.
And you mentioned skateboarding. There is – in one of your globe-trotting adventures, you're in Iceland. We see beautiful landscapes and mountains. And then there's this long downhill mountain skateboard ride that it looks like you're doing.
Now, that is me, yes. I had the CGI there is just removing a safety wire that was attached to an arm that was on the truck that was in front of me that the camera was on.
Uh-huh.
So basically that arm was there to yank me off the skateboard in case something happened, which happened a couple of times. But then I was basically pulled up off the skateboard and I was like dangling from this arm like a marionette going 40
miles an
hour.
I want to see those scenes.
I have them. They're going to be on the DVD and the outtakes.
There are some moments in Walter Mitty that remind me of some of your earlier directing work. These movie parodies you've always done with this incredible, great, meticulous mm-hmm. verisimilitude. Tropic Thunder, we saw some of that. But I remember that you were doing these 20-odd years ago in the Ben Stiller Show. I want to play your trailer to a non-existent movie called A Few Good Scouts.
Your scouts follow orders or people get wedgie.
You want answers.
I think I'm entitled.
You want answers.
I want the truth.
You can't handle the truth.
You want the truth.
I want the truth.
What do you want?
The truth.
When do you want it?
Now.
Give me a T.
T.
Give me an R.
R.
Give me a U.
U.
Give me a T.
T.
Give me an H.
H.
What's that spell?
The truth.
All right. You got it.
You do a great Tom Cruise.
It's a little hyper. That sounded a little...
He's shown himself to be a little hyper occasionally.
I know, but I think I was really... I don't know what I was doing there.
That was one of those shows that didn't run for a long time, but those who loved it still love it.
Yeah, no. I mean, we were really lucky to get on the air, actually. I think we, Judd Apatow and I, produced it and created it together. And we were just so green and trying to figure out what we were doing and... I don't know if we had not gotten canceled, if we would have been able to figure out how to.
So that was
keep
fortunate, you think?
A little bit. I mean, yeah. It wasn't a relief at the time, but I do remember thinking like we were shooting more and more sketches that we kept on cutting to get to enough material for one show because we didn't know how to keep up.
In movies, one of your specialties are characters like Zoolander, this idiot in this insular world, which you satirize, and then. Sort of idiot actors in Tropic Thunder. Is that just because that's a go-to comedy trope, or is there something about these particular little worlds and the morons within them that appeal to you?
I don't know. I mean, I've never really analyzed it. But for me, there's a certain seriousness that all those characters have about themselves. They take themselves too seriously. I don't even think about them being, idiots or morons as much as just people who really, really take themselves seriously.
And in your versions, they tend to be sweet.
Yeah. I mean, I think, it's trying to find a character that if you can, want to do that where the audience can somehow latch on to them and somehow, find some way to empathize with their egotism.
The first feature you directed was Reality Bites, about a bunch of recent college graduates trying to find their way in the world. Winona Ryder plays one of these. She's a would-be documentarian, and you play her corporate boyfriend working for this MTV-like entity. And at the end of the movie, she finds out that you've totally recut her work in order to play successfully on the network.
I don't even think you realize what you've done. You don't get it. You just don't get it.
I do get it, but look, you have this great piece of work, all right? And we have this audience, these kids, and it's like trying to feed them meatloaf or something, and they don't want to eat it, right? So you gotta have to give them, like, here comes the plane, it's coming into the hangar, open up the hangar. I mean, but it's still meatloaf.
It was never meatloaf.
That, That's a bad... Look, I'm sorry, all right? They were just trying to market it, and I wish I could
Your
be
voice
perfect,
is about
okay?
a half octave higher,
I mean,
too.
I wish I could be like Troy riding on his
Sounds like the Tom Cruise impression.
Like, dare bring Troy into this.
Hey, I wish I could be like him. I mean, I wish I could live off of creeds and mottos, but I'm in the real world here, okay? And I have ideals also. They're that I care about you, and I want to make you happy, and I'll make them take the pizza thing out, okay?
Now, in that scene, obviously, 20 years ago, we were supposed to identify with Winona Ryder's idealism. 20 years later, do you feel like, my character wasn't all wrong?
All I remember about that scene is that Winona wasn't wearing a bra, and that's all the audience cared about was looking at her dress. You know, in terms of what that was saying, I do think that's sort of a very valid sort of real thing, though, in terms of, you know, like the commodification of, you know, creativity and all that stuff that's still valid today. I
mean, which is a sub-theme in Walter Mitty as well.
Yeah, I think so. It's funny because, like, I just noticed – I haven't heard that for a while, and he says I don't live by creeds or mottos, but, like, the whole, you know, movie, Walter Mitty is about this, you know, life's motto.
Yeah.
You know, and he does have – you know, he cares about that. He does – that character does care about that.
I read that you've been trying for 15 years to make a movie out of the great George Saunders story about a theme park called Civil War Land in Bad Decline. It seems incomprehensible to me that you, man of billion-dollar comedy franchises, couldn't get somebody to put up $25 million to make such a movie.
Yeah, no, it is to me too. I mean, it's one of those things. You know, it's a dark story. It's a movie that I've gone around with for a long time, and I think could be a great movie. George wrote the script. You know, George happens to be, as everyone knows, a brilliant writer, and right now he's, you know, people are recognizing that. Which
right, and it's about this down on its luck theme park, and it's dark, but it's funny.
It's dark and it's funny, and it's its own sort of tone. And sometimes when there are movies that don't quite fit into one genre or another, it's hard to get them financed. And that's one that I wanted to do for a long time.
And meanwhile, however, as I was told last night, I didn't know this, that your Night at the Museum movies have permanently increased the attendance at the Museum of Natural History by like 50%. So you've done good in the world.
Well, it helped the children of the world.
Help the children.
That's good to hear.
Yes. Congratulations. And congratulations on this film.
Thank you.
Ben Stiller, thanks very much. The Secret Life of Walter Mitty is in theaters everywhere right now. I'm Kurt Anderson, and you're listening to Studio 360. It's 1957. The lights have just gone down. 1,000 people take their seats. The set, the dancing, the costumes, all fantastic. This is clearly going to be a world-class production.
We're as happy as we can be. It's a golden opportunity.
If you're having trouble placing this show, don't worry. It never appeared on Broadway. Richard Paul explains.
And that one once in a lifetime is not.
What this is, and don't worry, there'll be more, is not what you think. It wasn't performed in a theater. It was sung in a giant hotel ballroom during a convention of car dealers to get them excited to sell the 1958, wait for it, Ford Edsel.
An Edsel dealer is a man of the hour, man.
It turned out to be the worst car ever to hit the American market, but that wasn't the point of the show.
It was to build morale and build a sense of being on a team. You weren't isolated. You were a part of a greater whole that was looking out for you.
Steve Young is a writer for David Letterman who's made himself the curator of the world's greatest collection of corporate musical theater performances like this one. They were cooked up by companies who had hired experts in a brand new and popular social science called human resources management.
There's a job I've gotta do if I'm gonna hold my own. Gotta sell a load of tires, gotta hit the road for home.
So at the big convention, say right after the 45-minute speech on sales projections by the vice president for East Coast Distribution, and just before they give out the award for most improved air conditioning trainee or whatever, and right before everyone left the hotel in search of hookers, there'd be these musicals.
Now you can fully explain heat loss and gain, air distribution too.
And you have learned design and you do fine on load estimating,
cost calculating.
The message at these shows was always the same. Our company is the best because no one sells our amazing product like you.
Standard equipment. You need that standard equipment. That's what sparks a buyer's flame.
Companies spent a ton of money on these shows, and they hired some of the biggest up-and-coming names in musical theater to write them.
For example, the writers who worked on this just a few years earlier worked on this.
Turn your tractors and implements to a bumper crop of dollars and cents.
That was the Ford Tractor Show from 1959, Sheldon Harnick and Jerry Bock, who went on to great fame with Fiddler on the Roof. And a few years later, another famous team wrote this.
Life is a cabaret, old chum.
But just a few months earlier, they wrote this.
Through your distribution system, our sensors can be giving information automatically.
Yes, Kander and Ebb, back when they were still hustling to make a buck, wrote songs like this one for a show where Benjamin Franklin meets modern utility executives. General Electric's 1966 musical, Go Fly a Kite.
Can you sense things well enough to make reports about?
Can do, can do. We can read folks' meters and make out the bills they get. What can't we do?
The waltz, I bet.
Now, sometimes these musicals weren't just hawking products. They were meant to solve hairier corporate problems. Barry Biern spent years writing these kinds of shows, probably a couple dozen over time.
There were some companies that were having personnel problems, and they used the musicals to help present the problems in a sort of an entertaining way as a jumping-off spot that they could then discuss the problems at their breakout sessions.
None of the songs from Barry's shows were ever recorded, and that's a shame because some of them sound like doozies.
We had two companies that were merging, and some of the employees were going to lose their jobs, and they used our show to introduce the staff to this concept in an entertaining way. They thought if they used a little razzle-dazzle, it might ease the pain just a bit.
Another time, they did a show for a bank that was going out of business. For that one, they did songs
that sort of poked fun at the leadership of the bank, which was okay because I think they were under indictment at the time.
My bathroom is a private kind of place.
What you're hearing now is arguably the apotheosis of industrial musical numbers from a 1969 record called The Bathrooms Are Coming.
It's an American Standard show that was performed in Las Vegas for the distributors of their line of bathtubs and showers and toilets.
The design was made for your comfort, divinely shaped for your comfort.
In the show, modern women beg a Greek goddess named Femma to get men to rethink the ergonomics and design of bathrooms. I'm not kidding.
Immediately, when you think of a musical about toilets, you can't help but laugh. It just seems so absurd on the face of it. And then you put the record on the record player and you're immediately, wow, I guess a musical really can be about this stuff because here it is. And not only here it is, it's really good.
So whatever happened to the bathroom musical? Well, times change. By the 80s, cheap video recording and editing equipment made it much easier for companies to put together a canned production and not have to worry about, I don't know, a high-heeled stiletto flying off and hitting the CEO's wife in the chin. Hey, live theater is risky. But while it lasted, it sure was great. Hey, man, shrug off that gray flannel suit. Loosen those Hager slacks. No, not for that. That's later. For now, sit back and relax, because, buddy boy, there's simply no one who can sell toilets or pump gas like you and me. For Studio 360, I'm Richard Paul.
Because a dealer's wife is a woman through and through. Yes, an Exxon wife is a woman through and through. Helping out my baby, because I love him, I do.
You can hear a few of the songs from the golden age of corporate musicals at Studio360.org.
And I can do an overhaul on the kitchen and make it truly shine.
And that's it for this week's show, anyhow. If you need a little inspiration in your life, stop by Studio360.org and read some of the creative resolutions 300 of your fellow listeners made for 2014. I do hope all of you who wrote us or called in fulfill those goals. Stay in touch with us during the week on Facebook. Find out what we're listening to, reading, watching, and thinking about, and let us know what you're looking forward to this year. Studio 360 is a co-production of WNYC and PRI, Public Radio International. Our production team includes
Vital Malad,
David Krasnow,
Jenny Lawton,
John Delore,
Sean Ramisferum,
Alana Harper,
Eric Malinsky,
Julia Lowry Henderson,
Julie Dorio,
Zachary McCune,
Felicity Sheehy.
Thanks as always to WNYC's Chris Bannon. Our theme music is by David Van Tegum.
Studio 360 is supported in part by the SC Group, whose charitable resources include FJC, a foundation of donor-advised funds at fjc.org, and by an award from the National Endowment for the Arts, ArtWorks.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Next time in Studio 360... Matthew McConaughey's performance in Dallas Buyers Club is at times reminiscent of his big break in Dazed and Confused. So, does he make the connection?
No, and I don't think there is one.
I'll argue the case next time in Studio 360 from PRI and WNYC.